Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and The Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, The Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, The Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business. Today, we're going to start with the topic of education. And I was wondering, Natalie, if you felt comfortable kicking us off and just why you came to this topic and a little bit of what you included in your email.
Sure. So I was originally thinking about this topic because I feel like it comes up a lot when you guys ask me questions about what my opinions are. And most of the time, I don't really have the strongest opinions because I just feel like as a consumer and as like a younger person, we don't get a lot of education about this. This isn't a topic that's talked about a lot, like among friends or in social groups or even at school. So I feel like it could be interesting to see what people are doing to try and educate consumers more.
So that's what we're going to talk about today, a little bit about, or a lot of bit about food education. And as usual, combining our different points of view. So I'm looking forward, Natalie, to learning more about how you do learn about food and how your family and peer group influence your decisions. I have tasked Peter with talking a little bit about how farmers can be advocates and whether they should be advocates, and potentially how what the consumer is looking for influences what they decide to grow. Like, is this the, you know, who's the chicken and the egg? Is it consumers demanding new products? Is it farmers making new products available? How does that work? And then I'm going to interweave in how we make produce affordable and how we bring these new products to market. So I think we have a full agenda today. And Peter, do you want to kick us off?
Natalie, thank you for bringing up this topic. And I think the way Michelle and I are both educators, teachers, this is an excellent topic for us to be discussing and diving into, because we're not there yet, obviously, if this is what you want to talk about as a young consumer or a young farmer. So I'm really excited to dive in on this. And ladies, through the course of the discussion, I'll try to add, as I usually do, some historical perspective and take us back a few decades to kind of lay foundations and groundwork to perhaps help us understand why we are where we are today and why Natalie is asking this question. Because just the fact that you're asking it, Natalie, is saying to me that I and my generation may not have done a good enough job, and it's time to now step up and complete the job. So thanks for bringing this to our attention.
So from a economic perspective, that to sort of dig into the history a little bit, like Peter mentioned, some of the research I've been doing recently does look at how our food system got to where it is today. And I think that we have really largely tried to maximize output and create efficiencies. So if we can produce a lot of produce in Salinas Valley in California or in Florida or in Yuma, we've really taken that to heart. We've really moved in that direction where we can, you know, have large scale production, where we can gain efficiencies of scale. And I think that the supports to agriculture have moved in that direction as well. So whether it's breeding for shelf stable products, whether it's packaging for longer transportation, whether it's mechanizing machinery, which you can do when you're on a much larger farm than a few acres. So all of those things are driving down the cost, and they are making food more accessible to consumers, making vegetables more accessible to consumers, which I think is something that we all want. Their complaint is that the food is not as tasty and as enticing as a product that is not designed to be transported and shelf stable and available year round. And I think that that's something we hear a lot from consumers, is that they want quality and taste and maybe not longevity. And so there's always that push and pull with price. So I'm going to throw it back to Natalie. I know that you've done a little bit of gardening this year, and it sounds like you have some family members with experience on farms and growing, and that you do purchase some of your food from grocery stores or your produce from grocery stores. So I guess I'm wondering, how fixed are your diet? Are you looking for new things? You know, where do you go now for eating inspiration?
So I think I'm definitely not like the target consumer in that I do like food. Like that's kind of how I got to this place. I like cooking a lot. I cook for my family. So I'm usually the one that does the grocery shopping, and I notice this a lot more than some other people might. But I think what I notice the most is like the effect that your family might have on what you eat. So because I cook a lot of the meals, people will just eat what is in the house, whereas a lot of other people, like, whereas if you are like living with some other people, you might eat very different foods. And I think that it's also a big effect would be the people that you surround yourself with, like at school. I think school education on nutrition is really important. And something that I was reading about a bit was that the education, while basically every school, about 91%, has nutrition education, it's only like 5 hours a year. So it doesn't really seem like we're learning that much about food in school.
And Natalie, let me just jump in. The 5 hours that you're talking about, that's 5 hours more than during my day in high school we ever got. So yes, you're correct. It's nowhere near what we need. But again, my perspective on this, as I go back and put myself in your shoes in high school. And by the way, I need to commend you. You're shopping and you're doing some of the cooking for your family. Michelle, we need to have Natalie and Renee on together. Wouldn't that be a nice conversation?
What I'm really thinking is once we're able to socially mingle again, is that we need to have a cookout or potluck.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting. I'm actually shocked to hear, I think every part of that statistic, Natalie, that I would have never expected 91% of schools have nutrition education. I mean, 5 hours a year just feels like a line item and not really an opportunity to learn anything. And I just sort of wonder, I don't know where that shift came from, but, you know, did we move away from it in more of a gender balance thing? Did, you know, we start eating in restaurants more so that we didn't need as much education? I think that nutrition education and financial education are both missing from our schools. And so I kind of wonder, I guess, now where, if we've identified this problem and we are concerned about American eating habits with 75% of the country either overweight or obese, I'm wondering where, how to reach the consumers, whether they're in schools, should it be part of the curriculum? Should it, you know, be tied to school lunches? You know, should it be guest speakers? Should it be Instagram influencers? I'm just sort of curious how you get this discussion of nutrition across.
Well, I think at school it can be really difficult because I know at my school, at least, they have done a lot of things to try and push like eating well. And I'm not sure if all of them have worked. Like, for example, the Michelle Obama thing in like 2008 was very big. And that made a big difference on what people were eating at school. But the biggest thing most people noticed was that the food quality just went down. Like people were going from having pizzas to having whole grain pizzas. And I don't think that did the best effect of like making people enjoy healthier foods.
Yeah, I feel like that happens, and I have this criticism a lot of like specialty products, right? So if you're trying to eat healthy, you might not eat a cookie, but you'll eat a gluten-free cookie, or you'll eat an organic cookie, or you'll eat a local cookie, and you know, it might taste better, it might taste worse, but I'm not convinced that you've really changed the nutritional value. So it's interesting to hear that by switching from pizzas to whole grain pizzas, how much of an impact are you really having on the overall diet? And all you've done is made kids less likely to eat lunch. So that, I mean, feels like one step, but not really changing the system. And how do you get, you know, more vegetables and fruit in the diets?
Michelle, I'm sensing that a movement is taking place, and the discussion at a national or international level. I'm reading a book on how healthy eating affects disease control, how you're healthier and can ward off some of the more serious health problems, issues, diabetes, heart conditions, et cetera. And, you know, if I use an analogy, Michelle, some of the professional athletes are now being very vocal about watching exactly what they put into their bodies. And for you and me here in New England, for years, Tom Brady was talking about how he eats and what he does not eat. And we all kind of, you know, snickered and scoffed at that. But, you know, years later, this is now becoming, as I said, a movement. And I think if we can learn from the athletes, now they have the resources to be able to do this much more easily than the common person. They have their own chefs. They don't do the shopping like Natalie's doing. They don't do the prep. But if they're getting the results that they're saying they're getting, and their bodies are able to perform better, longer, and that starts filtering down to us, I see more and more cooking shows on television, Michelle, that are addressing these types of topics. And I find myself going to these shows, being drawn to these stations and networks more than I have in the past.
I hope that there is a moment that we are in right now where we can capture this. And I do think that, you know, health and wellness and that awareness is top of mind with the pandemic. I also think that, you know, realistically, the government is going to be purchasing more food in the coming months with more children on school lunches and other programs. And I hope that there's an opportunity there to purchase more from local farmers and producers, because you're supporting the local economy and you're getting those fresh fruits and vegetables into the schools. And it could be schools or hospitals or prisons or anywhere that public money is spent. And I think, you know, Peter has said it more than once that there's just a huge difference. I mean, I have these cherry tomatoes and I don't love tomatoes, and I could sit there and eat the whole pint raw like candy. And so, you know, is it, instead of substituting down where you're now telling high schoolers that they need to eat whole grain pizza that they don't like, how do you give them fresh tomatoes or fresh strawberries that they're excited about eating? And taking it back to the farm level, you know, what role can farmers play? Is it, you know, making that produce available? Is it being like Renee and figuring out that lunchbox peppers are really cool this year and all the kids want to eat it? Is it speaking at schools? Is it, you know, marketing their products direct to consumers more? Like, how do we, I think that farmers are considered a strong advocate and that there's an opportunity there. I just constantly worry about always putting more work on the farmers.
Well, Michelle, that and as you said, you tasked me with a few of those questions, and I've given thought to them. And if you ask me, how can farmers be advocates? Should they even be advocates? and can they learn from their consumers? The answer I have is yes, yes, yes to all of those things. And I think in prior episodes, we've discussed and had as guests some local small farmers. And I think part of the oxygen that they breathe is interacting with the consumer at a farmer's market or through a CSA arrangement. And I think that's going to be an anchor in this discussion that Natalie's bringing to our attention. The farmer absolutely is part of this. And Natalie, how exciting would it be if, as a high school student, or even prior to that, middle school, even down to primary grades, if we could invite farmers into the school? Shouldn't every high school across the country have a greenhouse so that we can be teaching classes? We used to teach woodworking and different skills in the high school environment. We may not be doing some of those now. That might be more of a trade school. But this issue or this concept of farm to table and locally grown and improving flavor and taste, how many things could we be trialing and testing in a high school greenhouse to show, we'd have one group of students go to the grocery store and buy carrots and zucchini and whatever, and then we'd have another group where we've grown them in the greenhouse and have a whole taste test, invite the families in, make a big day out of it.
Yeah, I think that could be a really cool initiative. I know they do some things like that in the elementary schools where they have like a small garden in the elementary school, but it's not definitely consistent among different schools. I do think it's kind of interesting that at a trade school, you'll find basically all of this. Like you have the home ec classes, you have classes about culinary things and growing. But then it seems like even though that happened, that was in public schools decades ago, that's completely disappeared, which I think is kind of sad because as we see, like not being really educated on what you're putting in your body and nutrition probably has a very lasting effect on you long term.
And Michelle, very close by in Middleton, Massachusetts, we have Essex Technical High School. And up to several years ago, its name was Essex Agricultural High School. So they've changed it to technical, and they've got all the construction skills and whatnot. And I was asked to be on an advisory panel or board for their horticulture department and got to tour their greenhouse 2 years ago, and it's state of the art. So at some level, as Natalie's mentioning, in the trade school space, we're seeing some of this where they're justifying building greenhouses and budgeting for greenhouses and have horticultural teachers on site to help address this community-wide demand. I think we should and could definitely expand this into the public high school arena, the public schools that Natalie's mentioning. There's so much of a payback that we would experience if we could just find the strength to spend the money to do it.
And I found it interesting. I saw a press release this week that at the next level, at the university level, that the University of Purdue has actually turned its on-campus farm into a fully functioning vegetable farm or produce farm that has a weekly CSA for students and people in West Lafayette and faculty to purchase from each week. So you don't actually pay in advance, you pay weekly for your box. And, you know, part of it is one, I think that it's teaching how to run a diversified farm. And two, it's showing that there is an opportunity with dining halls not functioning like they normally would, or restaurants not functioning like they normally would, that people are looking for other opportunities. So, I mean, at the university level, there's at least one example of more education in both production and marketing And I hope that that's a good sign for the direction that we're moving at that level.
And Michelle, I'll share an experience that I had. You're a Purdue grad. I'm an Ohio State grad. Several years ago, I was on campus at Ohio State, walking across campus and walking by the athletic facility, the gym that all the students use, not the athletes, but the students. So a brand new, shiny, huge gym with everything in it, from pool to weights, all this. And what struck me was outside the main entryway, there were some raised beds with vegetables. This was during the summer I was on campus. And there were nice little placards and descriptions of the vegetables. And I stopped, took pictures of it with the gym in the background, and I've used them in presentations since then on this topic of how we're getting to young people. And isn't it, a smart move, because first you've got your students that are interested in exercising and being healthy, and then walking in or walking out of the facility, they're being educated at some introductory level to the benefits of having the fresh vegetables right there.
Yes, and I think access to fresh vegetables is one big piece of it. The other thing that keeps coming to my mind that would be really important as far as education is understanding how that we grow food. And I think one of the things that really sticks out for me is in the first discussion with Renee, we talk about how he decided that he wanted to produce organically, and instead of spraying his potatoes, he sat there and picked the beetles off one by one. So understanding those trade-offs and what that means and how difficult it is to be constantly battling, whether it's raccoons or beetles or fungus and all of the hard work that it takes to be a farmer. And so for me, I think that's one place that farmers can really share education is, yes, like we can talk about our favorite foods or, you know, have access to different products that we've never, you know, tried before and be innovative and, you know, cook creatively, but also the amount of work it takes and the challenges that it takes to actually get food to a point where it can end up on your table. And so I don't know if this is putting you on the spot, but I think one of the places that we can really help is, you know, Natalie, if your schools or other people that are listening are interested, I mean, I think that Peter and I can, you know, start to reach out to farmers and see if we can find people that are willing to have this conversation and, you know, meet and really move forward with explaining how we farm and how, you know, how we get food to people.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I think that the elementary and middle schools, it would have the biggest impact because they're always looking to have like little days where you learn about a different part of the like Massachusetts and what's going on in different careers. And the high schools are not very open. Like everyone's always stressed about their testing and the curriculum and stuff. But I think having an impact and like being a little kid and learning more about vegetables because they can be so picky would be really important, and the teachers would definitely be open to that.
Michelle, wouldn't it be productive if on a platform such as this, if we had either a high school principal, middle school, primary school principal, or a district superintendent, along with a local farmer, to be able to facilitate a conversation like that, either in person someday or in an environment like this for an episode, how we would all educate one another. Wouldn't that be cool?
It would. It definitely would. And then I think you also have to include the parents, because it's great to come home excited about whatever the theme of the week is. In my case, this week it was Africa. My daughter learned all about Africa. But now I have to be the one that takes her to Africa 4 times this year. So, you know, it is good to get the children involved. And I think also figuring out how to engage the parents would be a second piece. And, you know, hopefully there are more opportunities to have this conversation.
Hey, Michelle, so you've asked me, you know, should canned farmers be advocates? And I'm going to answer it now in a slightly more economic way. And I'm going to say to you, yes, it is a time commitment. It is an effort for them to do that. But as you and I, as the three of us have been discussing locally grown and whether the consumer is willing to pay a premium, that premium is the carrot. That's the magnet that's pulling the farmer to the table to have conversations like this and to be advocates. They can't do it for nothing. We cannot ask them or expect them to give us their time and then learn from them simply to turn around and buy the vegetables cheaper at the supermarket. So there needs to be a two-way commitment made. And as a quick analogy to this, Michelle, I've often brought up my days as a garden center operator, and most of my family's career as we spent 50 years with a family-run garden center, we were able to say the following. We can charge a premium in our prices because we offer service that many others don't offer. So for us, it was quality and service, and that was the equation that on the other side of it meant a higher price. Now, as we battled and battled big box stores over decades, and we've talked about this whole progression in prior episodes, the ceiling that the mass market would install on some of the prices, at some point, if the ceiling was low enough that we couldn't charge enough to make that whole equation work. And we didn't cut back on our service, we didn't cut back on our quality, but we just ground to a halt after a number of years and there wasn't enough profit to keep going. So as I interact with you and learn from you the economics of removing costs from the production or the marketing and all of that, I'm trying to learn from you, but also feeling from with my farmer's hat on that the price has to be higher. There's no other way we can do it without having a premium if we're going to be asked to do the advocacy, the education, interact with the high schools, all of this. It's a complex picture that I think I'm confident can work, but I get depressed from time to time, and I've shared this with you, Michelle, that why does everything always have to be so cheap? So let me stop there and let you two jump in.
I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And I have more than once this week been told that, you know, the price that consumers want to purchase items would put all farmers out of business, and the price that farmers can produce would create food insecurity problems. So there is definitely a misconnection between what it takes to grow food and what people expect to grow, what people expect to pay for food. So I 100% agree with you there. And I, you know, the best solution I have right now is the reason that food is so cheap is because there are a lot of externalities in the system. So we're not actually counting all of the cost. We're not counting when we think about what our food costs, we are not paying for redredging waterways with soil erosion. We're not counting the water abatements before the drinking water comes back in. We're not paying, you know, we have subsidies in our food from the government, and we're eating food that's making us sick, which is as a result of the, you know, diabetes and the stroke and the heart disease, like you mentioned earlier, it's severely raising our health insurance costs. And so my question is, if we can internalize some of those externalities, if we could eat more expensive food but lower the healthcare cost, does that put, you know, people in a better position? If we can lower government payments for, you know, environmental or waterways or so forth, can that money go into purchasing healthier food or education? So I think that one, there's a misconnection between reality of what it costs to produce food and what people are used to paying. And I think that, you know, Danielle weeks ago explained that farmers already work really long days. And so asking them to then be social media marketing experts or, you know, educators on top of it is a huge ask. And so how do we come up with a better way that every answer doesn't fall on the farmer? How do we find advocates that understand farming? Or how do we reward farmers for their time and not just assume that they will pick up all the slack? And so that's why I asked if there's time, because I am conscious of the fact that there's not.
Those comments are perfect, Michelle. And it's, as we walk through this episode, every time there's a pause, I keep coming back. It's full circle. It's education. And it's what Natalie asked us to discuss during this conversation, which might spill into more than one episode. It's a recurring theme. And it's, I think that the equation requires you and an economic input, Michelle, because it's very complicated, what you're describing. And just because it's complicated doesn't mean we should be afraid to tackle it, but it is all coming back to what Natalie's asking. We need to understand more. We need to educate ourselves and each other so that the answers are easier for us to latch on to. You know, it is what you just said, eat healthier food. It's less in healthcare. And those are concepts that are very difficult for the everyday consumer to grasp and understand, but that just means that we need to work harder as educators to get the message across.
I agree. And it sounds like Natalie is interested in listening and interested in learning. So maybe there's an opportunity to smooth some of this out.
Definitely. I think something that I noticed when I was trying to like find more statistics about how consumers or people that are in the school system are being educated is there was basically next to no information. Like there were not very many statistics or documents. I found like one website by the CDC about the minimum amount of hours of health education. And I think that's really telling about what the emphasis is on what people, on how much knowledge people actually have about the food system and how that probably should change.
Michelle, last night watching the news, I leaned over and said to my wife, you know, the young generation now becoming young adults and about to step in as leaders, we can help them. We can facilitate them as the older generation, but many need to just step aside and get out of the way. And I hope I'm not in the latter category. I'd rather consider myself as a facilitator and do whatever I can to help Natalie and her generation. Actually, Michelle, your generation, you know, as the age group of my kids, and just do what I can, do what we can as people have been around for decades longer, and listen to you folks and bring whatever forces to bear that we can. And then otherwise, just get out of the way and let you guys plow ahead.
I think it's going to be a team effort, just like this conversation with three different perspectives. I think that it is learning from people that have been there, as well as asking the right questions, as well as willing to pick up the torch and do the hard work to see change and to make progress. So unless there are any final thoughts, I want to thank everybody for listening this week on The Engrower and The Economist. And like all summer, it has been amazing to have Natalie here to use her statistics throughout our discussion and to have her perspective.
Thank you. I thought it's been really cool to see so many different perspectives, especially because you guys have a lot more knowledge on this, obviously, and you are in such different careers and have such a different age gap.
Thank you. You too. Talk to you next week.